Please be seated. Before we begin with our second case, I want to go over the times that have been given to me, just so I'm sure that counsel and the bench are on the same page. So if I read something to you and you don't believe it's correct, please correct me. That's the purpose of going through it. We're going to begin with 25 minutes for Attorney Berkey, and then 30 minutes for Attorney Flanagan, and then 5 minutes for Attorney Markovitz. Is that correct? Very good. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, Justices of the Court. May it please the Court. I'm Attorney Nicholas Berkey of the law firm of Von Briesen & Roper, and it is my honor to be first appearing before you. It's the first time in my career. Seated at counsel's table is Attorney Alan Markovitz.
I think it's not his first time, I say in jest. He's been here many times.
I believe the first was 1959, I heard this morning. But we are arguing together the case of the petitioner plaintiff in this matter, Metropolitan Associates, who owns and manages various apartment complexes in the city of Milwaukee and throughout the state. This case, although a property tax assessment case, is not simply about what one appraiser says the property is worth and what the city assessor contends in response. If it were, we would not be before the court today. This is a case about a fundamental principle of tax assessment law, which requires the assessment of a particular property at the fair market value that property would sell for on the open market, using the best information available to the assessor, practically available to the assessor, for that particular property to achieve that end goal.
Well, when you say that, when you say fair market value, counsel, and I read your argument in the briefs, and the thought occurred to me that your client's proposal would be the best case for a potential purchaser of the property coming in and saying, what's the fair market value of this property? And what's the best way to tell that? Examine the books, see what the actual expenses have been. But the other thought that occurred to me was, okay, say we do this. Say we use the precise number that landowners who rent out property, whether in the residential or commercial property businesses, and we use their numbers, are we not setting up the system, and of course your client would never do this, but for those who might be less scrupulous, are we not setting up the system for want to be one that is ripe for abuse? Those who might want to manipulate, for instance, their tax liability could do all sorts of maintenance, could spend all sorts of money on upkeep and what might be viewed or could arguably be viewed as reasonable and necessary upkeep. And one who is not in a position to do so and not in a position to reduce their tax liability would just have to be scraping along. How do we safeguard, if we adopt your client's method, how would we safeguard against such manipulation?
I do not believe that our position would create such manipulation. In this case,
don't you at least acknowledge the incentive created or the possibility for that created?
I acknowledge the possibility, but in this case, there was no dispute
we
about
have
the accuracy.
To be we have to be concerned about this case, and we all seven of us are very concerned about this case. But, of course, the law that emerges from this case will not just apply to your clients.
That's
will
correct.
Apply to every similarly situated landowner out there. And so we have to be concerned with the big picture. And so that's what I'm asking you to do right now, is help allay a reasonable concern, I think.
Yes.
Or tell me it's not reasonable and tell me why.
Well, I think it's a reasonable concern if you are thinking that property owners would simply inflate their expenses simply to save on property tax, or that they would spend more money than necessary to simply save on property tax. One of the important things to remember about this process is it's a long process and it's a very open process, where the city has the power to demand this information after you have objected to your assessment. The city requests income and expense information well in advance of setting an assessment. When you object to an assessment, the city, the Board of Review, has subpoena power to subpoena documents, backup documents, even federal income tax records, which we supply often to the city. They have the ability to cross-examine those that authenticate the income and expenses of the property. In this case, and we made it very clear in our briefs and it's clear on the record at the trial court, there was no dispute about the accuracy or the validity of these expenses. There was only simply testimony that was unrebutted authenticating these income and expenses, saying that these are the true income and expenses necessary, and most importantly, the expenses necessary to achieve the income that these properties were achieving, and that these are what they pay taxes on. To say that you would want to have less NOI in order to save on your tax bill, I don't believe anybody in the open market would be doing that. But most importantly, I think there are many, many safeguards to avoid that situation where you have to provide your leases, you have to provide your backup. The city has all that power, including, I emphasize, the income tax records of the entity that owns the property. So I think that concern is alleviated by the fact that, A, in this particular case, and the court can emphasize that the accuracy and the validity of the expenses, the city and any municipality that's assessing and using that income has the ability to look into that, has the ability to subpoena documents, has the ability to make a determination as to whether they agree that it's accurate or it's valid. In this case, the testimony was that they agree that it's accurate or valid. It just happened that the expenses were above average for the general market, different properties, not the exact subject property in this case. So I think that's a legitimate concern, but there are safeguards in place that would prevent that from occurring. And frankly, I do not believe that property owners are going to actually spend more money without the end result actually gaining more money. So as long as there are safeguards in place to protect the accuracy of the information and the fact that the market supports, we're going to try to maximize our NOI.
I know one of my colleagues has a question, but I guess very briefly, the converse would be the property owner who is not as prosperous, who's trying to scrape by to make ends meet, make the place habitable, and is meeting the needs of a market, of a low-income market, perhaps, and so they don't have as much money to do maintenance and upkeep and cosmetics and repairs and all that. So their taxes go up because they don't have the actual expenses.
No, I would disagree with that because you're just looking at the expenses. You're not looking at the NOI, which is the result of both income and expenses. If somebody is spending less because the property is in poor shape,
yes,
the market is going to demand much less for the income.
True.
And as long as the income and the expenses are legitimate, valid, accurate, you're going to have a lower NOI and you're going to have a lower assessment. So I think you need to look at it not just in the context of expenses, but
right,
in the context of NOI, which is the result of the income less the expenses.
And
that's what a purchaser would look at. Excuse me.
I have a question. I really want to know what your position is as to how this property should be assessed. As I read your brief, and I'm looking at pages 16 and following, it's your position, as I understand it, that under the Regency case, shouldn't be using the concept of mass views of the assessment.
that you have to look at the best information for full value here and not use general information about expenses. You've got to use these particular information, and you base it on Regency. Now, I want to know, that's what I read in your briefs. So, is it your position that this mass assessment, mass appraisal technique, that's what I'm talking about, is wrong, can never be used? Is that your position?
That is not our position,
okay.
Your Honor.
So what's your position first about mass appraisal technique?
Our position, we tried to address it in the reply brief. I think some of what causes the confusion here is the fact that we're sitting here on one day in 2015 or in 2017.
Can you use mass appraisal techniques or not?
Yes, you can use mass
yes.
appraisal assessment right. techniques.
But it has to be accurately done. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. Our position is that what is getting missed is the timeline.
Is what?
What is getting missed is the timeline involved with the assessments and how the initial assessments are set, when an objection is made, and when the assessments are really final. In this particular case, with the city, under Section 7047.16, a property owner is required to file an objection before the third Monday in May.
All right.
Before that, they set the initial assessments.
Right.
Our position is it's perfectly reasonable for the city to, at that point, when they are assessing 150,000 properties, all these different parcels, to use these massive appraisal techniques.
Okay.
But once that objection is filed, as the manual supports, there should be a single property appraisal done looking at the best information available. In the initial stages, when they have 150,000 properties to assess, the best information practically available, we would agree,
right.
is using the mass appraisal techniques.
Okay.
But the second that objection is filed, and they don't have 150,000 objections filed, not even close, that they have 6 to 7 months before the assessment is final when that tax bill gets issued and when it gets finalized on the tax roll. And the city frequently makes changes. In that period of time, they have the ability to request information, demand information, review the information.
You start out with mass appraisal, but once the taxpayer objects, then the city is going to use an appraisal specific to that property.
Your Honor, I think that conforms with the statute because at that time...
Okay, I'm just trying to understand your argument. That's your argument, right?
That's our argument because they have information available. Now, if the taxpayer objected and didn't give them any information...
Okay, now,
maybe a different
situation. They didn't change the assessment, is that right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed that.
So did they change the assessment after the objection? They
did. They
so
did
now,
not in this case.
Now we're in circuit court, right?
Many years later in circuit court, yes.
Okay. And at circuit court, what is the obligation of the city to show the assessment, and what's your obligation?
I think if the city had followed the law, they would have done a single property appraisal in the 6 to 7 months that they had.
Okay, but they didn't.
They didn't in this case. That is correct,
Your Honor. Right. Okay. So does that kill the city, or does the city have an opportunity to present evidence in the circuit court?
I think the city has the opportunity to present evidence in the circuit court to defend the assessments.
All right. And they're now defending a mass appraisal assessment, right?
In this case, because they didn't follow the statute, they are, yes, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
My point in this case is because they did not follow the statute and do a single property appraisal when they had the information available after the objection, in this case, they are defending a mass appraisal assessment years down the road, yes.
As to the specific property, right?
As to the specific property.
And when they put in evidence as to the appraisal of this specific property, is it the same as the mass appraisal assessment, lower than or higher than?
In this case, the city, the only evidence that the city presented at the trial court was the actual chief assessor for the city of Milwaukee testified and had done single property appraisals by this point. which were completed well after the assessment was final. And those single property appraisals were not just slightly had above the assessed values. They were, in some cases, $3.5 million above the assessed value which I think we highlight in our briefs.
So you got the benefit of the mass appraisal because they can't increase that number in circuit court, isn't that right?
I would agree that by the time that the tax roll was finalized, that the city or the court of the circuit court could not have issued a new tax bill and charged new taxes. No,
right.
Not,
okay.
They could not have done that. I agree with that.
Counsel, have you considered 7049 and the presumption of correctness, not in regard to whether the evidence you put in was sufficient to rebut the presumption, but whether the city's own assessment, which in one case was, I think, 22% higher than the mass appraisal, really gave up on behalf of the city the opportunity to rely on 7049 and its presumption?
We've given more than just thought to that, Your Honor. Thank you for the question. We've taken that position consistently in circuit court when this has occurred. Unlike Regency West, the case that was before this court before, where they had the assessors testify supporting and defending the assessments, what they did, and then an expert, separate experts, testifying to their values, the city just simply put Mr. Weisenfluh on the stand, who was the chief assessor when these assessments were set, and he testified, as we've taken consistent position, that the assessments were wrong. It's simply that they should have been significantly higher. So, court, don't look kindly upon these property tax owners because they got a break.
Counsel,
that's,
I'm looking at...
Can he finish answering just a sec?
Okay, he's finished.
May I finish? And I think that the key point I want to make on 7049 in this case was 7049 is based on, and I believe it's 7049 sub 2, an affidavit. That affidavit is signed by the chief assessor saying that these assessed values I'm putting in this assessment rule, I swear are correct. That same chief assessor took the stand in this case and said, well, it actually should have been $3.5 million higher in one case. All the other cases it was higher. I think that at the very least, yes, there should be no presumption when that occurs. In fact, we took the position in the Circuit Court of Appeals. The city rebutted its own presumption in this case as one element of why the presumption should not have been applied as it was applied by the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals in this case.
Good. Thank you, Ann. Thank you.
On page Appendix 108, we have the testimony that you're referring to. And I guess I see the testimony, at least on Appendix 108, a different shade than what you are asserting. So maybe point me to someplace else that supports your assertion. On page 108 of the appendix, the question is, and to the assessor, and you're not asking that the assessment be changed to the sales comparison approach value, correct? And this is the answer. No, the assessment can't be changed at this time. All I'm showing is that my work supports the original assessment, and I conclude, therefore, that the assessment as made was not excessive. I heard you to say something different than what is on page 108. Is your position that there is something different, or is your position that the assessor said that the information that he was now providing was meant only to indicate that the original assessment was not excessive? So is there something else other than 108?
No, I think they're consistent, Your Honor. I think what we're also getting at here is the difference between trying to just justify your assessment and actually defending your assessment.
Yes, I found that part of your argument interesting because sometimes we dance on the head of a pin. The last oral argument, very important questions, designate versus select, and now you talk about justify versus defend. And when I was reading that, I circled that and I thought, well, isn't a defense
trying to justify what you did. I think of my children as they were growing up, and when I would take them to task for something, they would defend themselves, but trying to justify it. Oftentimes the justification was, but Mom, you made me do it. You know? So
yes, well,
tell me the difference between justify and defend.
Yeah, I think there's a subtle difference, but it's an important difference. Because what we're seeing communities do throughout the state is they don't stand by their number. Their number is what they put in the assessment roll, and it's supposed to be accurate. And you're supposed to have a period of time, and the statutes have set up a long period of time for the municipality to make that an accurate assessment. And rather than focusing on it being accurate, they simply want to see if the taxpayer is willing to go all the way to court, and then they justify their assessment by coming in with a much higher value. I think that is a very important distinction, especially when we're dealing with presumptions of correctness, and especially when we're dealing with such an important right. As this court wrote in a recent decision involving the town of Dover, this is a taking of property. This is a very important right that should be protected. And the accuracy of these assessments, when you get that assessment bill, is important. And it's very important also for a taxpayer that does object way back in May to have the ability to say to the assessor, here is the information that I have that is the best information on the value of my property, and not to just have the assessor ignore it, stick with the mass appraisal assessment, but to have that taken into consideration because the statute requires the best information.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Is an assessment based on the results of a mass appraisal technique entitled to the presumption of correctness?
I think if they are using a mass appraisal technique and they are then presented with better information and they still stick to that mass appraisal technique, I would say no, because they have not followed the law. One of the reasons that the presumption of correctness is rebutted is if you do not follow assessment law. And by not using the best information.
In what specific does a mass appraisal not follow the law?
It does not follow the statute, which is 7032.1, which says that you must consider the best information practically available to the assessor.
Okay. Now, a mass appraisal technique is authorized by the manual, correct?
Correct.
And the manual is authorized by statute.
That is correct.
The statute says use the manual.
That's correct to a degree. There's case law that we've cited. Instructions in the manual, which is this thick, and has many different provisions that you can interpret in many different ways, cannot conflict with the statute.
Okay.
That's very clear.
And is the mass appraisal technique then, does that technique conflict with the statute?
Actually, I do not think it does, because the mass appraisal technique, as the manual makes it clear, mass appraisal techniques are to be used when setting initial assessments. And then single property appraisal techniques are to be used to defend, it uses that word, the assessments. So our position has been that mass appraisal has its place. The manual makes it clear where its place is. Its place is dealing with very large revaluations of communities, like the city of Milwaukee, under 50,000. But once there is an objection made, there's a reason that the statute gave you 6 to 7 months. Once an objection is made, better information is provided, that assessor needs to consider that information under the statute, and as the manual also says, it needs to defend the initial assessment or change the assessment. I would like to make it clear, that just came to my mind, the community can raise those initial assessments. They can raise them significantly. We've had assessments raised as late as November. So there is a period of time here where when better information is presented, it is the assessor's obligation to consider that information. And that is what the city didn't do in this case.
How do we decide what constitutes better information such that the presumption of correctness no longer applies to the mass appraisal?
Well, I think that would obviously be on a case-by-case basis, but there's in this case, mass appraisal, as the testimony shows, is statistical sampling. It's an averaging. There is no question that information on an average property is not as good as information on the specific property being assessed. And as Regency West held, this court held recently, directly interpreting 7032.1, the best information available in that case was the actual income and expenses of the property. And in fact, in that case, it was actually the projected income and expenses of the property.
It sounds like what you're saying is that the statute requires that the assessment be based on the value of that specific property rather than a mass appraisal statistical derivation. Is that your position?
I would agree. And the statute also goes on to say in the same sentence that it's what that particular property would sell for in open market. I mean, I think that's what everybody sees as market value. Market value is not what an average property would sell for. One of the things that I think I need to highlight for this court, the Court of Appeals in its decision said that the assessor accepted the income of the property, the income of the property, because it was within the range of the market. But it didn't accept the expenses of the property because it was above average. There is a big difference between average and within the range. And, in fact, the record shows that our expenses were within the range.
Counsel,
what we admit is they're above average. Excuse me, Your Honor.
Yeah. There were appraisals done on a Tier 2 and a Tier 3 format for this property. If the court were to look at those, which tier should be more persuasive under our law, Tier 2 or Tier 3?
Under our law, it's very clear. It's Tier 2 as long as you have enough information to do a Tier 2. Tier 2, just to emphasize, is, and my red light is on.
Yes, please.
Is comparable sales of comparable properties, and the manual goes through that you need to make adjustments for that because, as we all know, no property is identical, even across the street from each other. And in this case, the property owner's appraiser was the only one that followed that, the only one that actually made the right adjustments and made those adjustments for economic characteristics. The trial court did find one thing right, and the trial court found that the assessor, even in his appraisal well after the fact, should have adjusted for economic characteristics but did not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Allison Flanagan, and I represent the respondent, the City of Milwaukee. This court should affirm the lower courts for four reasons. First, the city's initial mass appraisal assessments complied with Wisconsin assessment law. Second, the city's single property appraisals, which were set in conformance with the manual, comply with Wisconsin assessment law. Third, Regency West does not stand for the propositions that mass appraisal is to be invalidated, that single property appraisals should be thrown out whenever their values exceed the mass appraisal assessment, and that actual expenses must always be used when valuing property. And fourth, Metropolitan's appraisals were inconsistent with Wisconsin assessment law and therefore did not constitute significant contrary evidence. In short, Metropolitan failed to rebut the presumption of correctness.
Counsel, isn't it true that this testimony doesn't show testimony by the city describing why the mass appraisal came up with the correct number? What was put in was another expert opinion that in some cases was 22% above the value in the mass appraisal. So where is the defense of that in the record? I really didn't see it.
Well, Your Honor, the city assessor testified that the initial assessments were done using mass appraisal, as this
That's
court
That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. That's not my concern.
Okay. And the manual specifically directs then to do single property appraisal to defend the assessments. The manual also explains that mass appraisal and single property appraisal are different valuation techniques.
Right.
And mass appraisal involves multiple regression analysis.
Right.
Which is essentially a formula that's developed, Y equals A times the number of square footage plus, to estimate fair market value. And so these formulas are then undergo statistical testing to ensure their validity. And the statistical testing is essentially when a sale occurs, running the sale through the formula and seeing what the value is, and then comparing it to the sale price. And there's difference. And so single property appraisal involves making adjustments, doing looking at comparable sales that may not be located in the city. And yes, the results are going to be different. I know in 2008, the result under the sales comparison approach was 22% higher. In 2009, it was 5% higher. And so these are just the results of different valuation techniques.
They may be, and I understand why they are different in this case. My question, though, goes more to your request for a presumption of correctness under 7049 for the mass appraisal. I didn't see anything in the record that validates the mass appraisal. By looking at it, looking at the number that was arrived, and describing why this mass appraisal created a valid, accurate appraisal of the fair market value of the property.
I think that goes to the burden that the Metropolitan has in case. If it's established that the city's assessments are... It's assumed that the city's assessments are presumed correct. So
that's what I want you to look at. I mean, I think you can defend a mass appraisal by talking about the universe and that it was comprised of like-kind properties and how you checked it to see that, in fact, it does bear out in subsequent sales and all of that. But I didn't see any of that in the record. Did I miss it? That's really
my
question.
No, that is not in the record. The record typically just says that the mass appraisal was done using the multiple regression analysis as required by the manual. And the reason it's not in the record, why the testimony doesn't go into how the assessment was done using a multiple regression analysis or the statistical testing that it underwent, is because the manual says to use single property appraisal to defend the assessment, which means the assessors have to go with single property appraisal. And single property appraisal doesn't involve multiple regression analysis.
I understand the difference in techniques. Thank you. I just want to be sure I didn't miss something.
Counsel, reference was made to the record. And in response to a question to your opposing counsel, he responded after setting the plate or the table that they're not objecting per se to mass appraisals, but rather the next step. What's the better? You have to then determine what appraisal is based on the better information. And a question was asked, well, how do you determine that? And he said it's a case-by-case basis, so I guess it's a case-by-case basis based on this record. The trial court issued a 9-page opinion and made certain statements. I'm not sure if they're findings of fact or they're conclusions of law. Generally, they sound to me like they could be findings of fact, and if so, then that puts our standard of review into clearly erroneous. The statements made is that the court finds more reliable the city's sales comparison approach than that used by Metropolitan, and it also asserted that the city's income approach was more reliable than Metropolitan's approach. Oftentimes when we talk about reliability, we also use the phrase credibility. So what is this? Are these findings that the judge made in a case, because apparently the better information is made on a case-by-case basis, I take that to mean under the facts of the particular case, and that the judge made these statements about which is better. Can you respond to that?
Yes. In terms of the court's findings and the fact, yes, these are findings of fact, and it's subject to a clearly erroneous standard. I understand that Metropolitan wants the city to use their actual income and expenses when valuing the property under a single property appraisal approach. The problem in this case is why the city didn't use their actual expenses, and that's not being highlighted. When Metropolitan provided the information to the city, compares it to the market. Market isn't just one number. It's a bell curve. There's stuff on the upper end of market, stuff in the middle of the market, stuff in the end of the market, and then there are outliers. Metropolitan's income falls within the market range, and so the city used it. Their expenses were an outlier. And they weren't an outlier because it was some inherent defect in the property, such that any purchaser coming in to buy the property would have these same high expenses. It was because their payroll was higher. Their payroll was higher than the comparables in the market. And this is established in Exhibits 12A, 12B, 12C, and 12D of each of the city's single property appraisals, because they assert that it's their maintenance and operations. But compared to the comparable properties used by the city, their maintenance and operation costs fall within their range. They fall grossly outside the range when it comes to renting, administration, payroll. And those are the reasons why the city can't use their expenses in determining the single property appraisal value. That's why the city couldn't make an adjustment in its sales comparison approach for their economic characteristics. Because their economic characteristics, their actual expenses, are not based on market. And the market require, or the manual requires, that everything in valuing property, in determining market, come from the market. And so there wasn't an adjustment in the sales comparison approach for their high expense ratio. There wasn't a use of their actual expenses and their income approach, because their actual expenses aren't based on market. And that is the fundamental unfairness in this. This property could sell tomorrow, and someone could purchase it and hire a management company and pay them market or have market costs, what is an appropriate within the range on this specific expense category. It has nothing to do with the property or what we are ultimately trying to value.
I thought that their utilities were very high for these properties, and that was a big factor in their expenses. Is that not correct?
It's not. And I think you're referring to their reply brief, where they point out in actual dollars their utilities expenses are higher than the comparables used by the city.
Yes.
What isn't emphasized is that their actual utility expenses are the utility expenses for six total parcels, three in the city of Greenfield and three in the city of Milwaukee. And of course their actual utilities expenses are going to be higher on a dollar basis, because compared to the city, who valued each parcel individually, the comparables relate to those parcels. And so in just terms of economics, a larger six parcel entity is going to have, on a dollar basis, higher utilities than comparables. Which
didn't they also put the same income, though, for that same grouping of properties? I mean, the income wasn't for a different number of properties than were the expenses, correct? Or am I
so in terms of their appraisal, how their appraisal did it was a little different than the city. They relied on their actual income for all six, and then when they valued it, they allocated
and their expenses, and big part of their expenses, I understood, was the utility bills for these apartments, which are 50 years old.
The comparable properties used for the city, the city did it different. They, because each parcel has distinct set of buildings, could potentially be sold off if Metropolitan wanted to get rid of two or four buildings, depending on how the parcels are situated. The city only valued the income attributable to that specific parcel. So by using the actual income, which they used their actual rents, they took the income for just that parcel, which is why if you look at the three different single property appraisals from the city, the income is different for each. And it didn't use the income for all six parcels in its analysis.
Council, can you talk to me a little bit about mass appraisal technique and our opinion in Markarian? And on Markarian, we described three different tiers of appraisal techniques, correct?
Correct.
And we said that if you can do a tier one, you have to do a tier one. Only if you can't do that do you move down to two, and similarly to three, right?
Correct.
All right. Is a mass appraisal technique, does that fall into one of those tiers?
Markarian has always dealt with single property appraisal, and I don't, for whatever reason, it seems that a thorough discussion on mass appraisal has escaped this court. This court has always dealt with single property appraisal, presumably because the manual says come to court to defend with single property appraisal.
And perhaps the statute says that too, right? I mean, the statute speaks in terms of valuing a particular property, doesn't it?
Well, the best, so a multiple, excuse me, so mass appraisal does comply with Wisconsin Stat 70.32 subsection 1.
Okay, so but first tell me, does it fall into one of the tiers of Markarian?
It does in the, not in the strictest sense, because Markarian really deals with, like, the method of valuation. I mean, Tier 2 is clearly a sales comparison approach. Tier 3 is an income approach or a cost approach under Markarian. Mm-hmm. And those things just don't happen in a multiple regression analysis.
Right, exactly. So let's take a look at that. Now, so when we look at our Markarian opinion, was that based on the statutory requirements, or is that something we just said, we'd like it done this way?
I presume it was based on the statutory requirements because WISSTAT 70.32 subsection 1 states the best evidence of value is a recent sale of the subject so long as the sale comports with the sale of other comparable properties.
Okay. So if Markarian is based on the requirements of statute, then how do you get to the mass appraisal technique being a technique that is authorized by the statute?
Because when the model and or formula is essentially derived under multiple regression analysis, before it can just be used, before it's given the green light to go and be applied to the assessment, it has to undergo statistical testing. And that's discussed in, I think, Chapter 14 and even 20 of the 2009 version, and then of the manual in the 2017, they renumbered them, so it's now in 9, 10, and 11. But they talk about comparing then the assessment or what comes out of the formula, which I'll call the assessment, to the actual sale prices. And if the formula is too off, it can't be used and it doesn't get confirmed through statistical testing. So
And that's within the discretion of the taxing authority, right? So you're the ones doing that behind the scenes. You're deciding, well, you know, is the mass appraisal number that I'm coming up with, does that look similar? It's close enough for our purposes. Then we go ahead and we say that's the assessed value, correct?
I do know that, and I'm not sure if this appears in the 2009 version of the manual, but into the 2017 version, in Chapter 10, I think it's page 50, 51, there is thresholds that in doing one of the statistical tests, the Department of Revenue has adopted that the formula or model for the specific group must fall within particular ranges. And I believe the thresholds or the tests are actually from the International Association of Assessing Officers, which I know the standards were cited by the amicus in this case. Mm-hmm. At least that's what's cited in the manual itself.
Okay. So if you could help me correlate the mass appraisal technique to the language of 70.32 sub 1, and I'm looking at the language that we use to develop those three tiers, right? So it says, in determining the value, the assessor shall consider recent arm's-length sales of the property to be assessed, right?
Yes.
So that refers to a specific property.
Yes.
So if there's been a recent arm's-length sale of the property, would it be appropriate to use a mass appraisal technique instead of that sale number?
Absolutely.
Why?
And the reason is uniformity. And so the uniformity concept is a constitutional concept, and it requires that everyone bear the same tax burden, essentially. And so assessments must be at fair market value. When the rate is applied, everyone gets the same proportion of tax burden. And we have problems in uniformity if people start getting assessed at different levels of fair market value. And mass appraisal helps smooth out the differences. I mean, you could have, for example, a subdivision where the houses are very, very similar to each other.
Yeah. Okay, hang on a second. I want to make sure I'm following you here on this. I think this is an important point. Isn't the uniformity clause, doesn't that relate to the percentage assessment after you've determined what the value of the property is? Right. We're not trying to normalize property values. We're trying to normalize tax rates. Right.
Yes.
Okay. So a mass appraisal technique is normalizing property values. The statute here says that if there's a recent arm's-length sale of that property, there's no smoothing out. You use that number, right?
I think at the end of the day, too, though, the statute also says to use fair market value. And I understand the market values property. Mass appraisal is designed to smooth out if two very similar properties next door to each other sell, and there's no good reason why one sold for $15,000 more than the other, to kind of not assess one at $15,000 more. And that's the second part of the statute that talks about making sure that the sale prices are similar to the comparable properties.
Well, while the justice is thinking about this, I'd like to go back to the concept of whether a mass appraisal is valid. Because part of that, what I hear is maybe from Justice Kelly's questioning and from the briefs of Metropolitan Associates, that it's a question whether you can use mass appraisals at all. And I'm looking at paragraph 23 of the Court of Appeals decision, which says, Metropolitan takes a puzzling approach on mass appraisal. It refuses to concede the obvious, namely that mass appraisal is an acceptable technique to conduct initial assessments. However, despite its statement that it will not concede the point, it subsequently seems implicitly to concede that it was acceptable for the city to calculate initial assessments using the mass appraisal technique. Now, my understanding is that here, they're not challenging, although I think there is some question in their briefs. I should ask it as a question. Are they challenging the validity of any mass appraisal technique for the initial assessment, or are they accepting that that's okay under the manual and the statute?
I think in their brief in chief, they question the validity of mass appraisal, but in their reply brief, they conceded that mass appraisal was an acceptable initial assessment method. And I think that's in part due to the practicability nature of having to assess 150,000 properties on an annual basis. The city of Milwaukee, although it has the largest number of properties to assess, also has the largest assessing staff. We have 27 appraisers, and if each of our appraisers had to do a single property analysis for every property, they would be doing about 15 per day, 365 days per year. And that's in comparison to a case that gets to litigation and a taxpayer's appraiser needs 60 to 120 days to do one single property appraisal. And so that's why the manual specifically says use mass appraisal to set the initial assessments and then use single property appraisal.
Okay, so when we get to court, the city wants to use a single property appraisal. What I heard opposing counsel say, too late, too bad, they had to do that before they got to court.
Well, there would have been the administration exhaustion requirement, so there is a board of review that the city defends the assessments on at that point.
And what did they do in the board of review?
The board of review, they essentially do...
Who's they, the city?
The board of review members, the members of the board of review. It essentially is a quasi-judicial body who does the same analysis that is done then in the circuit court. So the taxpayer comes in, says my assessment is incorrect, here's why I think it's incorrect, and the city presents a single property.
Is that done here?
I believe it was for the early tax year. I think that because of the pending litigation, they just stipulated to proceed up to
the circuit court.
Yes.
Okay. So they get to the circuit court, and the city introduces its view of the assessed value of these specific properties, and Metropolitan Associates brings in its experts on specific property, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, you were asked about whether Mercurian follows the statute. That was a very early case. I think it was 1970.
Yes, very early.
very early. And when I looked at it in relation to, and it's a case that came after, I think, this case, Malewski. Are you familiar with that case?
What case?
Malewski. Malewski versus Dover. It's a 2017 case that was filed July 7th.
Yes.
2017. And it deals with the issue of best information. That is, on a view or obtaining the information, most practicable. When I looked at it and looked back at per curiam, it's hard to find these three tiers in the statute. Do you find it precisely in the statute?
They're not precisely in the statute. Okay.
It's a court interpretation of the statute.
Correct.
It's been followed since 1970, hasn't it been?
I believe it has, right. Yes.
And no one's asking to reverse per curiam.
No.
All right. So we have three tiers. And when it's your position, I gather, that the city can bring in evaluation of the specific property, even if they didn't do it earlier in
Correct.
The administrative. Okay. But it's their position. Seems to be gone. I mean, is that how you interpret their position?
I think that they're interpreting that. No, I don't, because the manual says that the municipality is to defend with single property appraisal, and so
they say the defend is different than justify.
Well, I think the dictionary they cited for that, if you look at the online thesaurus, they're actually synonyms of each other, and so it's a little bit of form over substance. Whether the city defended or justified, the city defended the assessments in this case through their single property appraisals.
Council, I have two questions I'd like to ask you.
Done. And the city brought in no sale of this property, so we're out of tier one.
Correct.
So then the city assessors, as I understand it, brings in comparable property. And when you deal with comparable property, you can make adjustments because comparable doesn't mean precisely the same.
Correct.
And that's what they did here, theoretically.
Correct.
And then they went into the income approach. That's the third tier.
Yes.
They didn't do the cost approach, which is also third tier, right?
Correct.
Okay. And on the income approach, they did not use the expenses, the actual expenses that Metropolitan wanted.
No.
And they used what they viewed as the market one, relying on the Walgreen case, isn't that right?
Correct.
Do you read Regency as requiring using their actual expenses or actual income? And Regency, I think, was actual income.
No, and Regency is an exception to the requirement that is in the manual to value properties based on market. Regency involves federally subsidized housing, similar to the line of cases such as Metropolitan Holding and Darcel, where there is actually an encumbrance on the property, a federal restriction that prevents the owner or any future prospective buyer from actually being able to obtain market rents on the property.
And Regency said, well, you didn't consider the federal restraints, therefore the assessed value was wrong, or the evidence was wrong.
Correct. It would be, I believe that the facts of that opinion state that they were using market properties along with federally regulated housing, not the same restrictions. And this case, by contrast, involves a typical apartment complex. There's no type of restrictions, nothing preventing a new owner coming in and getting market for the property.
The trial court here, in its decision, which is in the petitioner's appendix, gave, as I read it, a presumption of correctness. Did you read it that way, too?
Yes.
Okay. But they also evaluated all the testimony.
Correct.
And found that the city of Milwaukee's testimony was more reliable and worthy of credibility.
Correct.
So do you think that, so what do they use, the presumption of correctness or the reevaluation of all the testimony or both?
I think it's a combination of both. The Metropolitan, to rebut the presumption, has to introduce significant contrary evidence. And the trial court found that the appraisals that they admitted into evidence were not significant contrary evidence because in the sales comparison approach, their appraiser's economic adjustment was based on a comparison of NOI, which the appraisal institute, which is the conferring authority that conferred upon that appraiser his professional designation, in their treatise, which has been cited by this court, says not to do that comparison. And moreover, by comparing based on the economic characteristics, it's Metropolitan's actual expense ratio, which exceeds market. And then the trial court also determined that in the income approach, the appraiser's appraisal did not account to significant contrary evidence because he used actual income, their actual high expenses in his valuation. His appraisal also indicates that he did use a quote-unquote market expense ratio, but cross-examination and the record indicates that that market expense ratio included national data, Midwest data. It wasn't specific to the city of Milwaukee, and if we looked solely at the city of Milwaukee, the expense ratio used by that would have been derived under this analysis, I think on average was lower than the city's, which would have resulted in a higher valuation. And so this circuit court's finding that the evidence wasn't significant contrary or that the city's appraisals were more reliable is not clearly erroneous and supported by the record. And the city's appraiser, in this case, the assessor, did testify that when doing his sales comparison approach, he based it on the market. The manual clearly says that a sales comparison approach is based on selecting properties that are comparable to the subject property that have recently sold. Because they're not identical, you have to adjust the sale prices based on what the market values, and he did that to estimate a value. He did the same for the income approach. He looked at what market income was. He was able to use Metropolitan's because it fell within the range of market, and then he had to subtract market expenses, could not use Metropolitan's because it was based on non-market indicators. It was too high for the market, and the reason why it was too high is not tied to the property, but to their payroll. And then he got a market net operating income, used a market capitalization rate to get a fair market value.
Counselor, under 7032.1, the property is supposed to be assessed at full value, correct?
Correct.
Setting aside 7049, it appears to me that what you're arguing is that even without the presumption, the way in which the petitioner's expert constructed the comparable sales approach as well as the income approach are simply inconsistent with what is required of those approaches, and therefore we should accept that they have not proved the fair value of the property.
I see my red light is on.
Yes, you can answer. Thank you.
Yes, and absolutely. Our position is, you know, the city did not lose the presumption of correctness, but...
But do you need it?
But even if we did lose it, the evidence at trial supports, or was not enough to show that the city's assessment was excessive.
Okay. Thank you.
I think I can say good afternoon,
yes.
Chief Justice, members of the court.
That's right.
I'm Alan Markovitz, and as was previously noted, this is not my first appearance before the court. Mr. Berkey correctly pointed out that it was my privilege to be here in November of 1959 to argue my first case before this court. And that also involved some issues that are quite fundamental to the process that we're looking at here today. And given the few minutes that I have, I just want to try to make a few observations for the court. The first I want to talk about is the relationship between the statute and the rights of the city and the rights of the property owner, because we are dealing with fundamental issues here. It's not unreasonable to say that when the legislature created the statute and wrote it the way they did, they never intended to allow the property owner to self-assess his property. nor did they intend to leave the property owner absolutely defenseless against the municipality's assessment of the property. Which brings me to this whole mass appraisal discussion. The city takes the position that mass appraisal is just wonderful, a new modern technique of statistical analysis, and they come in and they tell the property owner, your property has a fair market value of this number, and that's going to be your assessment. What does the property owner have to deal with? Property owner may have recently purchased the property in the open marketplace and paid a certain price. The city says that doesn't mean anything. That's not as important as being adjusted to the market. The property owner can own an income-producing property, an investment property. And I'm going to assume here that the taxpayers' records are carefully scrutinized as to accuracy, completeness, integrity, because no one will stand up here and say that the property owner can put whatever numbers they want out there and that's going to determine the value of the property. Like in all other cases in which evidence is tested, evidence can be tested here as well to determine what the truth is. But I come back to the property owner. The property owner is told, doesn't make any difference what you bought the property for. Doesn't make any difference what your broker told you you could get for it. Doesn't make any difference what your income is. The city has the magical answer in the statistical appraisal. We might as well then say that the property owner has no basis on which to come forward and object. Next point I want to make is...
Counsel, before you get to the next point, it seems to me that because after the initial appraisal, there is the duty to defend with the best information, and tier one information typically is considered the best information, that your argument is faulty, because if they just purchased the property, they can come in with the tier one information
But I heard the city say here today, that's not important if it doesn't comply with the market. I want to point out that we disagree fundamentally with that position. We agree that the tiers that have been established and used for years are correct. The next point I wanted to make
Counsel, are those tiers inconsistent with a mass appraisal technique?
The question is, what is the utility of the mass appraisal technique? If it's a beginning, it's fine. If it's all that there is in the process, it cannot work in the real world in which people in this state own property.
Well, if it's authorized by the statute, it gets the presumption of correctness.
There's not a word in the statute that talks about mass appraisal. The statute requires each property to be valued at what it would bring at the marketplace open market.
So your position is that the city can use a mass appraisal
To
set the value, but it's not entitled to the presumption of correctness because it's not authorized by the statute.
That's part of it. I want to point out that the best information available is not just the kind of best information available that we're talking about in this case. The city can come out when they do in the spring and say, here's our view of what your property is worth. But the property owner, let's say, is living in a single-family home. There may have been a fire that occurred in that property before January 1, which is the lien date. And the property was in damaged condition on January 1. The best information available affecting the value of that property for that year requires the assessor to take into consideration that on January 1, nobody could live in the property, and there was a $40,000 estimate to repair the property. It can be an income-producing property that has had a wonderful run of good income for the past 5 or 6 or 10 years, but the major tenant in the building went into bankruptcy in December, and that affects the value of the property in the open marketplace on January 1. I want to come back to Justice Gableman's good question about safeguards.
Very briefly, Counsel, because your red light is on.
Okay, I'll make this the last thing I say.
Thank you.
The city asks for information before they issue the mass appraisal. This is not a case where this information is hard to come by. In this case, the city did not ignore the information. They cherry-picked the information. If you look at the record, you will see that the testimony of the assessor for the city was that the income was within the income range, the expenses were within the expense range. They cherry-picked and used the income, ignore the expenses. Why? Because if you ignore the expenses and reduce them, you increase artificially the net operating income, you capitalize it then into an indication of higher value, hence a higher assessment. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much for fine briefs and for very good arguments this morning. I always find these cases most interesting, so we appreciate your significant efforts on behalf of the court, and we will give it very careful consideration. We are now going to adjourn. Thank you.